This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. There are a lot of once famous Cincinnatians whose stories have been all but forgotten. A few examples: Cincinnati was the home of the first black Olympic champion, the artist who created the comic strip, and the inventor of the Magic 8-Ball. Enquirer librarian and history writer Jeff Cease uncovers the history of these individuals, as well as some of the many forgotten events that took place here in his book, Hidden History of Cincinnati, which goes back to a time before Cincinnati was even Cincinnati. You can join us at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Jeff, so good to see you this afternoon. I have to apologize, I've been mispronouncing your last name all this time. It looks like Seuss, but it's Cease.
It's Cease, yeah. It's Dr. Seuss is actually EU. And mine's UE.
Oh, okay. Well, I've been getting it wrong, and I just have to say I apologize.
It's no C's. Problem.
Now, what got you started writing this book about Cincinnati's hidden history?
Well, I've been I'm the librarian at the Enquirer, and I've been writing about local history for the last few years in the paper, which I generally get to choose the topics, so I find things that interest me. And I did a book for the History Press last year, Lost Cincinnati, about old buildings and stuff. And they had asked me about doing another book. And of the topics, the things that they were interested in, hidden history, the unknown stuff, really kind of felt like it was more about something that I was interested in. So I kind of went through my knowledge and, you know, took some of the topics I'd written about in the paper and dove back into them again to kind of retell those stories so they were fresh. But that was kind of the type of thing I was interested in, is the Cincinnati facts and people and things that happened here that we just don't pay enough attention to and deserve a little more spotlighting.
Give me an example of one, somebody who really jumped out when you were doing the research on this.
One was Cora Dow with the Dow Drugs drugstores chains. In fact, while I was writing the book, I wrote about her for an article, and I went, you know, this would be great for the book. I decided to kind of reincorporate that in. And Cora Dow was started a whole chain of drugstores, Dow Drugs in Cincinnati. At the time when she passed away in, I think it was 1911, she had the second largest chain of drugstores in the nation, even more than Walgreens at the time. And
this is impressive too, Jeff, because this is before women's suffrage. This is before women.
Absolutely.
She's a successful businesswoman before women even got the right to vote.
Right. 1880s, 1890s. This is a time when there were very few women pharmacists, very few women entrepreneurs, and here she was doing both. And the kicker of it all is she really had no interest in doing these things initially. She did them because her dad was a pharmacist and she took over her dad's store when he got sick. She really wanted to be an opera singer. And when she died, she donated most of her money to the Cincinnati Symphony as an endowment that they still use, I believe. And so her legacy, not only in the drugstores and stuff, but also in, you know, music in the city.
Well, another interesting thing too is she's a very progressive businesswoman, but yet she didn't support women giving women the right to vote, did she?
At the time, because I think you know, she's from such a different era that she felt like her situation was she had to step up because no one else was there to do it. She had to pay the bills. She didn't set out to do things differently than everybody else and change the system. She set out to just make a living so she could survive. And so I don't think she thought of herself as quite the pioneer that really she was. And, you know, we're all products of our time and, you know, opinions and standards and things like that. I mean, if she lived maybe 20 years later, maybe she would be more recognized today, and maybe she would have been more online with the suffrage movement and things like that.
Tell us about the research that went into this book. How did you uncover all these hidden stories and details and facts?
A lot of the stuff I can pour through the old newspaper files, which are great because I have pretty easy access as the librarian to the old files. And so I can read original stories and find out what happened, how things were covered at the time. So sometimes there's stories you've heard vaguely about. You know, I had heard about Annie Oakley is an example. The long, well-known story of Annie Oakley in the shooting contest with her future husband in Cincinnati. So I thought, well, let's take a look at the original news stories and find out, you know, what did the Enquirer have to say about this shooting contest? And I couldn't find the articles. So I did more digging, and I grabbed every book from the library on Annie Oakley, and there are no contemporary accounts.
Really?
Of when it happened. So I started to question, did it happen at all? Where does the story come from? And so then I started pouring through different sources, even her own journals and stuff. And eventually, I think the source of the most popular version of a story is a autobiography that Annie Oakley wrote right before she died. But it wasn't published until after she had died. And so we don't know how much was changed before that. And she has the whole descriptions, and she talks about visiting her sister in Fairmount and things like that. But the date's not there. And near as I can tell, I can guarantee that if it happened, it did not happen at the date that people generally associate with it. You know, if it happened at all, it would be about 5 years later. But the facts from her account do jive that you can sit here and say, yes, this hotel that she worked with to provide quail that she would shoot, that was in existence, and that was the guy who owned it, and her sister did live there at this time and stuff like that. So it's kind of detective work that's kind of fun to go through the files.
Could you ever verify the part of the story that says she beat her husband, her future husband, in that shooting contest? Did you ever figure out whether that was true or not?
Well, both of them say that that's true, that that's the story. But they were, her and her husband were also both show people. You know, they that's part of their act as well. So I couldn't really find any really – all we have to say is their word on these stories. There's no extra witness to the event.
How far back do you go with this book? What's the starting point for it?
Well, the starting point in real Cincinnati is probably the pre-revolution – or during the Revolutionary War, what was going on that. But I also did a chapter on the like the Indian mounds and how little we really understand about the native people who were living
Serpent in Mound, for example.
The Serpent Mound. And I kind of focused on the Serpent Mound, and it's how we do all the – not we, meaning modern-day people are doing tests on stuff, and it completely changes the way we understand things. And I kind of wanted to incorporate that to illustrate how, you know, history is somewhat changing in how we understand it. And heck, that we don't really know what was here before the settlement here. You know, that's still kind of a mystery. It's a hidden history.
When was Cincinnati settled? What year was that?
1788.
Okay.
It was December 28th off the top of my head. And when the first boats came down and settled, it was the second of three settlements. We all settled within a month of each other. The first was Columbia, which is now the Columbia Tusculum. Second was Cincinnati, originally named LeSantaville. And then the third was North Bend. So we were all settled in within about a month of each other.
And this was the first American city that was founded after the American Revolution, right?
Yeah, the first like city that really developed after that. And so kind of the point of being the first American city is that it's there obviously weren't natives here, so that means people are being either transplanted from the east, a lot of from New Jersey, or it was going to be built up by immigrants. When that really happened with the obviously the German immigrants that are well known here, but obviously Irish immigrants, things like that. So Cincinnati built up after America was really founded, and it wasn't a pre, you know, an old British city or French city or things like that, like the other cities had been.
Now, Cincinnati wasn't the site of a Civil War battle, but you write about the Siege of Cincinnati, mm-hmm. which is just a fascinating story because there we had the Black Brigade that played a significant role in protecting the city from the possible Confederate invasion. So can you tell us more about that?
Sure. Yeah, there was a lot of word coming up that the Confederates were on their way to Cincinnati. And so they declared martial law in Cincinnati, and everyone was called in to protect the city. And the African American population, who had volunteered before and had been snubbed and basically told, well, this is not your war, they basically didn't respond to the call for come to arms. And so they were forcibly removed from their homes and conscripted into this force. And it was a local judge, Dixon, who was mortified by this. And so he went to the general who was in charge, Lew Wallace, and complained. And Wallace said, you know, they deserve the dignity of volunteering. So he sent all of the African Americans home and asked for the volunteers. And something like three times the number of volunteers showed up the next day. Now, they were not allowed to be the soldiers. They were the workers, the laborers, who then crossed over into Kentucky and built all the fortifications to protect against the siege. Basically, then the Confederate forces looked at the city and said, well, we were supposed to just walk through the city and take it over. That's not going to happen.
Not going to be that easy.
Yeah. And they had need of soldiers elsewhere in Kentucky. And so they ended up abandoning it and never actually having a battle. But that's because of the work of the Black Brigade and the other citizens of Cincinnati who prepared to defend the city.
So something else interesting. The first train robbery happened in Cincinnati. I said, really?
Another fascinating tale happened in North Bend, so just down the river. And it was right after the war. It was in May of 1865. And guys took skiffs across from the Kentucky from Kentucky, across the river, and they pulled out, picked up one of the rails from the train and derailed the train. And the newspapers all had accounts of people telling stories about, you know, what they did to hide jewels and money. This one woman unrolled her hair and hid money into her hair and rolled it back
up. To keep the robbers from finding it.
To keep them from finding it, and then kept a couple of bills out so that they would be suspicious that they didn't have anything. So we have all of these people actually telling their versions of the story. And officially, the robbery was never solved. However, within a couple of days, there are news accounts of some guys going into a small town in Kentucky, and they're spending a lot of money, and they're, you know, buying a lot of alcohol at the saloons and stuff, and they left behind some bonds that were just part of the bonds of the robbery. So.
Now, for Bengals fans who are really upset about the team's performance this year, they should probably cheer up, shouldn't they? Because this is not the 19. And this is something I never knew either. There was a 1937 Bengals team that
Absolutely.
Existed. Yeah,
yeah.
They weren't very good.
No, they weren't very good the first year. They got a little bit better for a couple of seasons, but they weren't in the NFL. They were in different leagues.
But they were a pro team.
But they were a pro team. Yes, a professional team. And they started in 1937, and that is where we get the name Bengals from. The founder, Hal Pennington, was around here, was a well-known baseball coach. I think he won a bunch of high school championships, a record number. And he had started the team, and he named Bengals after the Bengal stove because he thought it sounded, you know, nice, fierce, you know, mascot sort of name. And so when Paul Brown got the new franchise, the current team that we know, there was a naming contest to see who what to name the team, and everyone picked Buckeyes. But well, we can't have Ohio State and and Cincinnati, and so he decided to go back to Bengals because it had a nice connection to that old team. Now they kind of ended when after this is the anniversary here after Pearl Harbor, and all of the young men go off to war, and so after the 41 season. There was not enough people around.
So the original Bengals lasted all of 4 years.
Yeah, 37 through 41. Their last game was the week before Pearl Harbor.
Did Hal Pennington and Mike Brown ever meet?
Oh, yes. There's actually a photo in the book. They got together in 67 when the Bengals were the new NFL – well, it was AFL franchise at the time. Pennington showed him the scrapbook. We have some pictures of him showing Paul Brown the scrapbook of his old pictures and stuff of the team.
Now, one of my favorite toys is the Magic 8-Ball. Just a great childhood memories, and I even still have one today. They're just a lot of fun. That has a Cincinnati tie that was invented by a Cincinnatian?
Yes, it was. In fact, his name was Albert Carter, and his mother was a well-known medium, and she would talk to spirits and things like that, and she actually did a seance for Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, the creator of Sherlock Holmes, and he praised her effectiveness. And so after she died, her son kind of took the idea of the slate writing that she would do and answer questions from the beyond and turned it into a question. They called it the psycho seer. And he met a couple of local guys who wanted to make toys. And there was a guy who was a graduate of the Ohio Mechanics Institute and designed it. And originally it was a cylinder. And they got it the patent done, and Carter passed away right at that time, but he had transferred the patent to these other two guys. And a billiard company in Chicago asked if they could well, they started making it into a ball after a while. And the billiard company asked if they could make one, a few of them out as an eight ball so they could sell it to their customers. And that's the design that really just caught people's attention.
So is there more hidden history to be told? Are you, planning a follow-up to this book?
There's tons of hidden history. We'll have to see. Talk to the publisher about a follow-up. But I think there's plenty of unknown stories. I mean, I recently did a story in the Enquirer about a World War I balloon jumper who won the Distinguished Cross and was shot down three times in 24 hours. And it's just here he was, a World War I hero, and he never really talked about a story until years later. So there's a lot of great stuff in Cincinnati if we just know where to look.
Well, Jeff, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Enquirer librarian and history writer Jeff Cease, his new book is Hidden History of Cincinnati. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition. You can find archives of our programs at WVXU.org. Pete Reitmeier was the producer for today's show with help from Jim Nolan. Belinda Kai was the assistant producer. Dave Shermer was the technical director. William White composed the Cincinnati Edition theme music. I'm Mark Haney. Tomorrow is the 75th anniversary of the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor, which brought the United States into World War II. On the next Cincinnati edition, we'll look at what life was like in Cincinnati on December 7, 1941, the day President Franklin Roosevelt declared a date which will live in infamy. We'll also hear about the latest research on the causes and treatments of migraines. That's on Cincinnati edition, tomorrow afternoon at 1 on 91.7 WVXU.